Good morning. Over 40 years ago, a stockbroker from New York by the name of Bill Wilson entered Towns Hospital on what proved to be his last drunk. He was an alcoholic, and at this stage of his life, he was quite desperate. He spoke to his family doctor, a Dr. Silkworth, and said words at least to this effect. He said, "Doctor, we both know that I am not a weak-willed man. My will is as strong as anyone else's. But for some reason or other, I cannot handle alcohol, no matter how much I will to. We also both know this. All the lying, all the conning is over. I'm not trying to lie about anything. I'm not denying the fact that I have an alcohol problem. We both know that I desperately want to stop drinking. We also know this, that I have done to the best of my ability everything suggested. I have tried prayer. I have tried religion. I've tried psychiatry. I've tried medicine. I've tried it all. And I have tried honestly. And here I am in the hospital because of alcohol again." And then, my friends, this man asked the question that ultimately proved to contain within its answer the answer to his alcoholism, to the alcoholism of many hundreds of thousands of others, and also the answer to a whole lot of other problems that beset the human animal. In his question, which came out of the desperation of a pained soul, out of that came this question: "I wonder, doctor, if I might not get sober by trying to help another alcoholic get sober." The goal was obvious. Self-preservation is the very first law of nature. But the means to sobriety was different than any ever suggested. The means was obvious: commitment to others. "I wonder if I might not get well by trying to help somebody else get well." I think it has been ultimately proven since Bill Wilson that one cannot obtain happiness alone, that one's sense of identity, one's fulfillment, and one's happiness is intimately wrapped up in the giving of self to others. The conclusion's obvious. No man can be happy alone. It just can't be done. But anyway, let's get back to the question. "I wonder if I might not get sober by trying to help another alcoholic get sober." And Dr. Silkworth, brilliant man that he was, said, "I don't know." To me, that's the mark of a truly educated man. A smart man is not one who knows what he knows. A moron knows what he knows. A smart man is one who knows what he doesn't know. And Dr. Silkworth was just as baffled by the problem of alcoholism as hundreds of thousands of professional people had been before and up to his time. And so, in answer to that simple question, he gave a simple answer: "I don't know." But then he must have added something like this: "Since nothing beats a trial but a failure, try." And so Bill Wilson, when he got over that drunk, he set out to try to help others. Meantime, he had gotten wrapped up in the Oxford movement, a religious movement of the day, and in talking to alcoholics, most of whom were end-of-the-liners like himself, he used these very sophisticated religious principles to try to help them get sober. All right, months went by, and in discouragement, he said to his wife one day, "I must have spoken to about 500 men and women with drinking problems like my own over the past 6 months, and they're all still drinking. I haven't helped a one of them." And his wife pointed out the obvious, and the simplicity and the brilliance of the fact that she stated stunned him into silence. She said, "Yes, but you haven't had a drink in 6 months." And he was startled, because it was true. So he had learned two things. The means to his own sobriety, commitment to others, was perfectly valid because it was working. He also found out this: that the means he was using to get others sober, very sophisticated religious principles, was not valid. It wasn't working. It's not that religious principles are not good. It's just that he was using the right means at the wrong time. What he was doing was trying to pound nails with milk bottles, and the milk bottles were breaking. What he needed was a hammer, but he didn't know it yet. In other words, my friends, the very first thing he learned about alcoholism is that the alcoholic is spiritually sick. He is incapable, in the midst of his drinking, he is incapable of a true, proper relationship with God because his relationship with God has been all messed up by the years of his drinking. What he was trying to do, bluntly, was feed spiritual meat to infants and they couldn't digest it. Back to Dr. Silkworth, he went, and he told him everything that had happened. And Silkworth said to him, "Well, Bill, I wonder if you're not using the wrong means. I just wonder if you're not using the wrong means." He said, "The next alcoholic you talk to, why don't you make an appeal that maybe you and he are suffering some kind of a sickness, an illness, a disease, whereby you just can't drink like ordinary people?" And he said, "Okay, I'll give it a try." Bill subsequently went to Akron, Ohio on a business deal. It fell through. He was very discouraged, and he experienced the desire to drink. What else can an alcoholic in pain do except seek the drug that alleviates the pain and paradoxically creates more of its own? Now, please, listen to this carefully. Don't ever knock just plain physical sobriety, because Bill Wilson's brain and body had been free of the drug that had, practically speaking, paralyzed his activity for a great deal of his life, anyway. He was now free of that drug, and his mind was clear enough to think this single thought: "Old buddy, you may have one drunk left, and you really don't want to go on it, do you?" And so, in fear and desperation, he ran down to the lobby of the hotel where he was staying and just pointed his finger on the, bulletin for churches. And his finger hit the name Tunks, an Episcopal priest, the Reverend Mr. Tunks, and he called him. Now, of course, I wasn't there. I didn't hear the conversation, but it had to go something like this: "Please don't think I'm a maniac or a madman for asking what I'm about to ask. Don't hang this phone up. But please, do you know a drunk I can talk to?" And the man said, "No." Bill said, "Do you know anybody that does? Preferably somebody from the Oxford movement." So anyway, Father Tunks gave him 10 names, and Bill struck out on the first 9. The 10th was Henrietta Siberly. She said, "Yes, I know a drunk. My family physician, who is practically dead of it." "He's practically dead of it. He no longer functions. He's flat on his back." Bill said, "Can I talk to him?" She said, "He's too drunk." He says, "I'll be there tomorrow." And it was in her kitchen, over the first pot of AA coffee, that the great fellowship of AA was born. And I would like to tell you something about it. Now, ladies and gentlemen, what qualification do I have to speak of this great therapy of AA? In the Baltimore area — I was born and raised in Baltimore, grew up there — I first became acquainted with AA in that area. And before every meeting, they read a prologue that explains the fellowship of AA. They tell what it is, what it attempts to do, what it does not attempt to do, and it concludes with this single solitary sentence: "We welcome and appreciate the cooperation of the medical profession, the clergy, and the public in general." Now, whether many of you know it or not, AA meetings are of two kinds: closed, which are for alcoholics strictly, and open. And that's exactly what they are. In order to gain the cooperation of the medical profession, the clergy, and the public in general, they say these meetings are open to any and all of you. We want you to learn about our fellowship. We want you to learn about alcoholism, and you are more than welcome. And it only reflects the beginnings of AA over 40 years ago, when clergy, through whom Bill helped to find, or who helped him to find, the 12 steps of recovery, and medicine, from which he learned a few of the physical facts about this disease, clergy and medical people were all around AA in its beginnings. And so today, this prologue reflects the desire to educate clergy, medical people, and the public in general. And in response to that invitation, I have attended many hundreds of open AA meetings over the past almost 20 years. I would like, with your permission, to share with you some of the things that I have learned about this great fellowship. From the very beginning, I picked up a definition of alcoholism that makes as much sense as anything I've ever heard. When Bill first approached Dr. Bob and met him in Mrs. Seiberling's home, he, in effect, said to him, "You've tried everything too, haven't you?" And the doctor said, "Of course I have." He said, "But you're drunk." The doctor said, "Yes." He said, "I wonder if maybe something is different inside you and me. I wonder if we don't have an aberration inside of us. I wonder if we're not sick or diseased or ill or something because we drink differently from other people. We don't want to be that way. In fact, we drink against our wills, don't we?" And the doctor's eyes opened. As a man with a scientific background, this appealed more to him than anything else that he had ever heard before. And one of the first definitions I ever heard of alcoholic, a definition of an alcoholic that I ever heard, a man stood up at an AA meeting in the Baltimore area and he said, "You know what's wrong with me? My filter's busted." And honestly, that does make as much sense to me as anything I've ever heard. "I know," he said, "that when I drink differently from other people. When I start to drink, I can't stop. I drink through euphoria. I drink past what I'm after. And I plunge into misery." And it makes as much sense as anything. Well, anyway, what Bill and Dr. Bob did was look at each other and say to each other, "We have nothing else to give each other except the sum total of our lives." And so Bill shared a lifetime of drinking and 6 months of sobriety, and poor old Dr. Bob shared a lifetime of drinking and about 6 minutes of sobriety. But that was the first AA meeting in which alcoholics share with each other so that they can see the samenesses in their drinking, identification, and the differences, which don't make much difference in the long run. And so they found two basic things about their drinking. For the alcoholic, when he drinks alcohol, it handles him, he does not handle it, and number two, it causes problems. And they both concluded that if they could control their intake without problems, they could drink. And they knew they couldn't. And so they shared with each other, and they shared with each other. They found out that if one person drinks every day and another drinks only on weekends, if one drinks the hard stuff and another only drinks beer, if one has hangovers and the other doesn't, if one drinks in the morning and the other drinks at night, all of these things are relatively unimportant when you get down to the two basics. No matter what you drink, when you drink, with whom you drink, or how much you drink, just this. If when you drink you cannot control your intake, it handles you, you don't handle it. And if when you drink trouble results, you're in and we are together in this. And so they reached out to other alcoholics, and this is the way the whole thing was born. So you go to a typical open AA meeting, and you hear people speak of the therapy that saved their lives. What these two men did, they reached out to the religious leaders of the day, they reached out to anybody and everybody, and they said, "Please help us." The name of the game of life, one human being reaching for the hand of another. "Please help us." They accepted, listened to, and tried to keep every resolution and every suggestion handed to them. They kept what worked and threw out what didn't. They kept what worked and threw out what didn't. And that is why, ladies and gentlemen, this thing is the most pragmatic, practical solution to human problems on the face of the earth. It is not a theory. It is not theoretical. I wonder or just suppose if we did this, this might or this could or this should result. No such a thing. AA therapy is the only one on earth that dares to put itself in the past tense. AA people say very bluntly, "We have done these things, they work." I personally have a theory about theories. If a theory is valid, it'll work. Don't talk me to death, show me. You know, you can have a theory about baking pies. You get the best ingredients from around the world, you use Revereware, and you bake it in a microwave oven, but good heavens, if the pie makes you puke, it's no good. No matter what your theory is. But we know for a fact, if people do all 12 of these steps, all other things being equal, they will get sober, they will stay sober. That's not a threat, it's a promise. And please, please believe this. These two men were not interested in writing a handbook of monastic spirituality. They were interested in finding principles that were going to enable them to survive. And so, what are they? Step one, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. The simplicity of acknowledging one's illness, it's so simple nobody can prove it. If you want to get well, you have to acknowledge you're sick.
Many, many alcoholics have a horrible problem acknowledging that they are alcoholics. All they have to do is see that their drinking caused problems, and that's what alcoholism is. My friends, there isn't a person on earth about to take on himself a regime of life as difficult as the AA way of life unless he sees the absolute necessity of it. And so, the alcoholic must not only acknowledge what his three-year-old can see, what everybody else on earth can see, he has to surrender to the fact, I am an alcoholic, he must acknowledge, somewhere in the guts of his soul. He must. The term is absolute, power less, because if on the back burners of his mind the alcoholic even faintly thinks he can drink again, he will. He will. And the only thing he has to do is look at the record. Whenever I am asked to speak to people in treatment, I just ask them the simplest question. How many of you got here for good behavior? Nobody ever got into a rehab center by mistake. It just isn't done. For people who think that they don't have an alcohol problem, I simply spell out to them that you're in a place for the treatment of alcoholism. This is not a sanatorium to handle people who have French fried potato problems. Alcohol is the reason that you are here. Many an alcoholic believes that the whole world is wrong but him. If only you knew this. If only you understood that. You're all wrong. And yet, wife, children, neighbors, boss, co-workers, friends, you know, everybody on earth is not in a conspiracy to take a man and dump him in an alcoholism rehab center unless they honestly see that he has alcohol problems. And the only thing I can say to anyone who has been told that he has a drinking problem is to say, look at the record. Look at the record. Look at the major problems in your life. Has the bottle been in the pitcher before, during, or after? Just answer this simple question about your own behavior when you're drinking. Do normal drinkers do this? Normal drinkers don't lie about their drinking. They have no reason to. And so I look at them and say, have you ever lied about your drinking? A lie is an unnatural act, and when you're drinking, makes you perform unnatural acts, lying about it, you have a drinking problem. That's alcoholism. To me, from what I've heard over the years, step one is not something that you just take and go on. Step one is an inner acknowledgement of one's condition. He says to himself, I cannot handle alcohol. I am an alcoholic. And yet many alcoholics are somewhat like the cadet at West Point. His parents showed up to see him graduate. And the parade going by the stands in review was taking place. And in the middle of it, the mother turned to the father and said, Henry, isn't that amazing? There are 4,000 cadets out there, and our little Georgie is the only one in step. Well, ladies and gentlemen, when the whole world is out of step but me, I'm out of step. I think that an alcoholic should take the consensus of the loving opinion of people who truly care for him. When they think he has a drinking problem, he probably does. It's the classic case of where there's smoke, there's fire. How do you know if someone's an alcoholic? How do you know if you are? I truly believe that any person whose drinking has become the topic of serious conversation on the part of people who are concerned about it is an alcoholic. It's the classic case of where there's smoke, there's fire. An alcoholic is a woman who called me on the phone about 3 years ago, spoke for 20 minutes telling me who she was and what she was, and then she came to the magic subject, alcohol. She told me what she drank, when she drank, with whom she drank, etc., etc., etc. And the only thing I'm doing is saying, wondering, you know, what's your point, lady? She finally made a flat statement, I am not an alcoholic. I said, congratulations, that's wonderful to hear. She said, what do you think? And I said, well, I don't know you, I have never met you, I've never seen you with a glass in your hand. And my friends, to this day, I wouldn't know if I fell on it. I don't know the lady from, except what she told me on the telephone. But this is what I told her. I said, you know, at this point in my life, I am ordained a priest 27 years, and in all that time, I have never had anyone call me long distance to talk for 25 minutes about a non-problem. The silence that followed, you could have done push-ups on, and I let it drag. And finally, when it got almost unbearable, I said, you tell me you're not an alcoholic. Fine. But if ever your drinking does cause you problems, give me another call. And I'm still waiting. The name of the game of staying alive is this. Alcoholism, whether you like it or not, whether you want to believe it or not, alcoholism is a fatal terminal illness. If the drinking is not stopped, the drinking will kill. It will kill. It is a terminal disease of body, mind, emotion, and soul. And it will kill if it isn't stopped. Step one, give in or you cave in. Your life was not unmanageable. Think back to the days of your drinking. I am led to understand that if a person has a drinking problem, drinking alcohol occupies about 95% of the alcoholic's waking thought. Here's an inanimate object that controlled the human mind. Most alcoholics will tell you that alcohol determined the people that they associated with and those they stayed away from. Determined the very restaurants they went into and those they stayed away from. Alcohol dictated the actions of their lives. Step one is a very serious thing. A very serious thing indeed. For no alcoholic will get well unless he sees that he needs to get well and acknowledges that he can't do it all by himself and has to reach out for help. So they usher the alcoholic into a room full of other alcoholics, and please God, in time, he... Step two. We came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. And so he enters the room, looks at sober alcoholics, and comes to believe that he can get well too. Now, what's all this business about a restoration to sanity? Ladies and gentlemen, it has been my privilege once to have met Bill Wilson, and I heard him speak, and he explained what he meant by that. The insanity of the alcoholic is not the nutty things he did when he was drunk. Non-alcoholics do nutty things when they're drunk. The insanity of the alcoholic occurs when, physically sober, he picks up the first drink of the next series. Quite bluntly, it is irrational to consume a drug that is killing you. Yet the alcoholic consumes that drug because he can't not consume it. How then does he come to believe that something will enter his life to prevent him from drinking? He comes to that knowledge, he comes to that belief by seeing it. I heard a man say that he entered a room full of alcoholics at his very first closed meeting. He said there were about 20-some people there, and every one of them said, I am an alcoholic, I'm sober 22 years. I am an alcoholic, I'm sober 8, 9, 14, 6. Down the line, he said, do you mean to tell me that the power to not drink is not in you? They said, no. He said, well, where'd you get the power to not drink? They said, outside of us. If it ain't in, it's out. Oh. So he had to come to believe, since he had already acknowledged that he was powerless, that he had to get the power somewhere else. Now, I don't know how much simpler that can be. If it's not in, it's out. And if it's out, you have to reach for it. A power greater than self. Many people have a whole lot of trouble with the notion of God. In fact, many people have a whole lot of trouble believing that there's anything greater than self. Well, the only thing I can tell any poor, sick, suffering alcoholic is to buy a mirror and look at it. And if within the space of about 3 to 4 seconds, you can't come to a realization that somewhere, someplace, there's got to be something bigger than what you're looking at, you've got to be sick. Good heavens, we depend on Cronkite for the news. We depend on the milkman for milk. We depend on the supermarket for food. Why should I have trouble believing that there's anything bigger than me? In any sense of the word, bigger. I heard this in AA circles, and it kind of turns me off. Somebody said, well, if you don't have a higher power, try that coffee cup over there. Well, good heavens. A coffee cup's an inanimate object. It's beneath and lower than, not a power greater than, any human being. I don't know why, but the people who always suggest to others that they take a coffee cup as a sponsor never get up at their own anniversaries and say, meet my sponsor and hold up some dumb coffee cup. Ladies and gentlemen, please believe this, please. If you could get sober through a coffee cup, you wouldn't need other human beings. I once heard a man say, I do not belong to Coffee Cups Anonymous, I belong to Alcoholics Anonymous. People get people sober. Now, how do we reconcile all this fear of a higher power and getting well? I always suggest that if you don't believe in a God of your own understanding, at least choose the power of the group. The group is bigger than you, and that's why the same guy who recommends a coffee cup in the next breath will keep saying, come back to meetings, come back to meetings, back to meetings. If you didn't need people, you could stay home if you have a coffee cup there. Come to meetings because that's where people are. And one of the most lovely, beautiful slogans in AA is, we can do what I can't. Strength in numbers. Take a string, a little kid can break it, but you take 1,000 strings, wrap them all together, you can build a hawser that'll pull a carrier. That's what AA is all about. The power of the example of sober people exerting itself on those who want to be sober. And so if you come to enough meetings, you will come to believe that you can be restored to sanity because you're looking at other people who have been restored. Step three, we made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood Him. Again, as most of you know, I happen to be a Catholic priest, but I'm not here to push Catholic theology. I would just like to share with you a few notions about God and man and the relationship between the two that I've been privileged not just to pick up because I felt that I have known these things before, but they began to gel when I attended these AA meetings. Nobody pushes his God on anyone else. Most people believe in a higher power that they look upon as a supreme being or God. Now, that's just a label for whatever supreme being you have in mind. But just as a common denominator, as a word that we can all use and understand, let's take God as each understands it. It is my belief that in all God-man relationships, God does two things. He provides us the power or the strength to do what needs doing, and then He gives us the means to exercise that power. He gives the power, but we exercise it. You've heard the term virtue before all through your life. The virtues. Virtues are nothing more than spiritual muscles. And like any muscle, it has to be exercised in order to remain strong. All right. In other words, God does not just make us sober. We don't have any right to the miraculous. God gives us natural means to the end. I'm sure that He could fill your belly at supper time, but I believe He wants you to eat. I do believe that He wants you to eat. Okay. What's the role that God plays in sobriety? I think He gives the sick alcoholic the power, the strength, to not drink. But it is the alcoholic that has to exercise that strength by doing certain things. What are they? The rest of these steps. The rest of these steps. I've heard some people at AA meetings say, well, I'm not afraid of drinking again, but my life is getting a little unmanageable. I think I'll get out of the driver's seat and have God take over. Don't do that. You'll have a wreck. God no more comes down and drives your life like He would a car than He would come down, get breakfast for you, or pay the rent. He just doesn't do those things. You know what God gives drivers? He gives them maps. But we have to follow the map. I drive my car. I drive it under the guidance of God by following the road signs and so on and the maps. But you know what most of us do? We take maps and shove them in the glove compartment. And I wonder why we get lost. And I say, hey, dummy, take the map out and look at it. And if you want to get sober, you take the guidelines that these two men discovered through other human beings as the great truths that God put on earth for us to live by. Step one, I can't handle it. Step two, God can. Step three, I think I'll get in touch. Now, what I have to do after making the decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of God as I understand Him, having made the decision, now I have to spend every day trying to do it. What is the will of God for the alcoholic to get sober and stay that way? How? By completing the program. What did these two men discover with all the attempts they had made to get sober? They had turned to God, they had prayed, and they got sober. But they always got drunk again. They always got drunk again. The idea now is to get sober and stay that way. The first three steps get you sober. The rest doesn't keep you that way. What is it that we have to do to stay sober? The big book, and I've read it and most of AA literature, the big book says, half measures availed us nothing. I've listened to the winners in these AA meetings. I've listened to the men and women whose sobriety I have appreciated. And every one of them has said this, you can or you may get sober on two steps, but you will on 12. Because by doing all 12 steps, you renovate the whole human being. You make the 180-degree turn. You do it all. They found out if they did 9/10, it wasn't enough. And so they set out to do everything. The first thing they did was to find out what it is they're working with so that they could build the rest of their lives on it. So they took an inventory of self, just like a new homeowner goes over every inch of his house, to find out what he's got, what he hasn't got, and what has to go. And it's the same way in human life. Let's say a man or a woman age 45 finds himself at the threshold of sobriety. He finds that if he takes an inventory of himself, step four, made a fearless and searching moral inventory of ourselves. Step five, admitted to God, to ourselves, and another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. They found out that if they took an inventory of their own lives, their very own selves, They found out what they had, what they didn't have, and what had to go. Now, ladies and gentlemen, please watch this. You will notice the steps coming in pairs now. 4 and 5 go together. 6 and 7 go together. 8 and 9 go together. When a person enters into AA, he says, if I want to get well, I have to admit I'm sick. He enters a room and looks. He comes to believe. He makes a decision to turn his life over to God. He spends the rest of his life doing it. He takes an inventory. He makes it known. He becomes ready to have his defects of character removed. He asks God to do it. He makes a list and gets ready to make amends, and then he does it. Prepare and then execute. The alcoholic before sobriety is characterized by lots of pep and no judgment. Lots of pep and no judgment. Many of you have heard me tell the story of the Alitalia airplane that took off from New York, headed for Rome, and right halfway over the Atlantic Ocean, the PA system came on, and the pilot said, hello, I said, do you see your pilot? He said, I've got two announcements to make. One's good news and one's bad news. The bad news are first. Announcement number one, we lost. But the good news, announcement number two, we're making a damn good time. Perfect picture of the alcoholic. He hasn't the foggiest notion where he's going, but he's getting there quick. Once you get well and once you get the fog out of the brain, you get the drug out of the system, the intellect is now clear. It takes its rightful place over the emotions. E over I plus AA equals I over E. Intellect over emotions again. Now the alcoholic is expected to use it. Prepare and then execute. Prepare and then execute. Because that's the way normal mature people act. And so he takes an inventory and then he makes it known. He gets everything set in his mind before he goes about rectifying things. What does the inventory show? It shows what the alcoholic has got. And ladies and gentlemen, when AA says that it demands honesty, it doesn't just mean honesty about the fact of one's drinking. It means honesty in every aspect of life. I hate the phony humility of people who deny what God has given. Oh, I'm not a very good singer. Or a fellow at an AA meeting. I'll never forget this as long as I live, and it was a disappointment to hear. I was at an open AA meeting in Baltimore many years ago. It was on a Sunday night. A man got up and he said, this is a quote. He said, when I was drinking, I was a drunken son of a bitch. And he said, now at the end of 14 years of sobriety, he said, well, I don't have much to show for it, except that I'm sober. Now people call me a sober son of a bitch. Everybody laughed. And I'll tell you the truth, I didn't see anything funny in that at all. If at the end of 14 solid years of living this magnificent program, the only thing you can show me is just that you're not consuming alcohol, I know that either something's wrong with you or something's wrong with the program, and I know there's nothing wrong with the program. Don't hear me garbage like that. God Almighty never made a nothing. Never. You better find out what God gave you. I have talents. You do too. Why were you singled out to be sober except to use your talents to save some other folks? You better find out what they are. You'll be able to use them one day. And you're going to be asked to make an account of them, too. Yeah, let me share this with you. It's a magnificent story I picked up from a friend of mine out in St. Louis. He was driving to the airport one day, and he said, let me share this with you because I think you might use it, and I've used it ever since. He had been in Chicago one time. He happened to be a member of AA. And wherever he goes into a different city, he always goes to the AA central office to find out where meetings are so that he can, you know, take in meetings while he's there. So he said, while he was in the office there, he met a beautiful black girl who said she was willing to take him to a meeting that night. So he met her, but she seemed to be very, very agitated. And he said, what's wrong? She said, well, I promised to take you to a meeting. But she said, I have a brand new girl I'm working with, and she's all upset, and she insists on seeing me right now. Joe said, no problem, let's go. So they met her in a bar of all places on the south side of the city, a very cute place. And this was the picture. This little girl is 23 years old. She's sober 3 months. And this is her background. From her earliest recollection, all this girl could remember was being a whore and a prostitute on the streets in order to survive, and she drank to do it. Her problem's very obvious. She's sober now and can't stand it. Hates herself. And because of this self-loathing, she said, look, I know that there's no God. She was so scared of God, she says there is none. So let's hear no God talk, please. And her sponsor says, the only thing I know to talk about is what I learned in AA. She said, well, I don't want to hear it. And this went on and on, back and forth. Well, of course, the girl's getting angrier. The sponsor is becoming more and more frustrated, and Joe knew that after a bit they were going to run out of conversation. And when they did, silence at that table, complete silence. And Joe used the opportunity. He knew that there was something in that girl. He wanted her to hear it from her own lips. He said, why do you want out of that life? It's the only life you know. And he said, she almost spit fire. He said, she came flying out of that chair. She says, because I'm worth too much. Now, by God, that girl knew that. She knew that. And the only thing I can do to alcoholics who are feeling sorry for themselves and I'm no good and this and that and the other thing, what are you worth? What are you worth? I've learned this from my mother, from my background as a seminarian and priest, and I've learned this from AA friends, what I'm worth. And I'll tell you what I'm worth. I'm worth the best. And if you don't have it, get out of my way. I'm going to go right around you. I picked this saying up from an AA friend, and I function this way, and I will, I hope, till I die. Margarine covers the bread, but it ain't butter. Now, just what are you worth? What kind of sobriety are you worth? Are you worth the sobriety that has to be bought only at the price of all 12 steps? Or are you selling yourself short for something less? What are you worth? Because if you feel that you're worth butter, you'll be willing to pay the price. And the price for truly quality sobriety, the price for quality sobriety is all 12 steps. This is why everyone needs a hero. Get someone in your program that you can look up to and shoot for the sobriety that he has. A friend of mine told me, he said it wasn't 12 steps written on a piece of paper to save my life. It was a man. It was the 12 steps carved in his life. And he said, I wasn't in his presence more than 10 minutes and I wanted everything he had. I wanted to be just like him. And for that reason, I would have died to please him. I've seen a lot of people come into LA desperate. And within a few months, they become their own sponsors and settle for a mediocre type of sober life. But my friends, if you want the best, it's available, but you pay the price. We admitted to God, to ourselves, and another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. Step 5. This is the one that separates the men from the boys and the big girls from the little girls. God already knows, so admitting to him is not too hard. But to admit to yourself what alcohol has done to you, what it has reduced you to, is very difficult indeed. And to admit one's complete real self to another human is very difficult indeed. Because every one of us is three. I am who I think I am. I am who you think I am. And then there's me. Now, the me that you think I am, well, I have to engineer that. Because I'm going to tell you things about myself going to make you like me. And I want you to like me. Hey, by the way, this is a little bit of an aside, but it's important. I've heard this from AA people, and it frightens me. Well, I don't care what people think of me. This is not a popularity contest. I do my own thing. Ladies and gentlemen, I do care what people think of me. Because if the consensus of the opinion of good people is that I'm a jerk, I'm probably a jerk. When the whole world's out of step at me, I'm out of step. I once heard a man say, if I live right by these 12 steps, I will automatically please God. And if I please God, I have to be pleasing to myself. And if I am pleasing to God and to myself, I will be pleasing and I will enjoy the respect of good people. The rest don't count. The rest don't count. But good people, I had better be careful of what they think of me. Because if they don't think much of me, I'm probably off track. I'm probably off track. For what it is worth, step 5 allows one other human being to know the real me. Okay, I've taken an inventory. I discovered I have talents that need development. I've discovered I don't have talents, so I won't waste my time trying to develop what isn't there for starters. I depend on other people to fulfill those needs. And then I see what has to go, my selfishness. And so I come very logically to the next 2 steps. We're entirely ready to have God remove our defects of character, and I once heard a man say that his defects really had character. And step 7, humbly ask him to remove our shortcomings. You know what I've learned? I've learned that in a normal spiritual life, God removes, he answers that prayer, he removes one's defects of character, one's shortcomings, in the same way he removed their alcoholism. In other words, he just doesn't wipe them out. He gives them the strength to get rid of them, and then the means to exercise that strength. What do I mean by that? Well, whenever I've been asked to, speak about alcoholism, and I speak of growth and so on, the only thing I can do is give a parallel from my own life. I think that one of my greatest failings is impatience. I think that's a universal human failing, to be impatient. Well, most of my life I have prayed to be a little more patient. When I thought of it, when I've become willing to have God remove my impatience. But you see, the great stumbling block to step 6 and 7, and I've heard some people say that they believe that's the most difficult part of the whole program. Once they get sober, growing is the most difficult part. For many reasons. Number 1, it demands self-discipline. Number 2, self-discipline is painful. And number 3, there's only one thing wrong with pain. It hurts. So we don't want to hurt. and therefore we don't grow. And I believe that pain is the fertilizer of real growth. We only grow through pain. And I believe that with a passion. So here is a person, let's say like myself. You get on your knees at age 21 and you say, look, Lord, I know that impatience is one of my greatest faults. Please help make me more patient. Now, somehow or other, and I don't know why this is so, but I simply believe God's going to do it. He's just going to wipe out impatience and make me a patient man. Well, he doesn't work that way. In effect, he says, all right, I will give you the strength to be patient, but what I'm going to do is arrange for a few incidences in your life and a few circumstances that's going to enable you to exercise your patience. And I usually fail to see them when they happen. Have you ever been to an AA meeting? And let's say starting time is about 8:30. And here's a fellow who comes busting in about 8:27. He says, holy smoke, what a day. Boy, do I need a meeting. I just went through the worst day of my life. I had a flat on my way to the work, on my way to work. While I'm fixing it, some guy creams my car and totals it. I have a fight with a secretary when I get in. I get bawled out by a boss for missing two sales. On and on and on. I get home. I'm late getting home because of traffic, and I had to get a cab, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. She burned the dinner, blamed it on me, and we had a nice fight, and I cut myself shaving, burned myself in the shower, but here I am, the worst day of my life. And some old-timer in the back of the room says, well, Charlie, it sounds to me like God Almighty gave you 25 chances to grow, and you blew them all.
Step 10 keeps you honest. It makes you continue to take an inventory so that when you're wrong, you can admit it promptly, resolve that guilt, and sleep peacefully tonight. Step 11. Listen to this from two derelicts. They tried to deepen their conscious contact with God through prayer and meditation. Sought through prayer and meditation to deepen their conscious contact with God as they understood Him, praying only for a knowledge of His will and the power to do it. This from two derelicts. You know, I used to spend a lot of time talking about prayer, that it is the most human activity of any activity we can perform. But I don't anymore. I save that for later. When I appeal to any alcoholic coming out of alcoholism and staying out of it about prayer, I make a simple statement. You know why you ought to pray? Because it's only fitting. It is only fitting to have some sort of a prayerful relationship with the God to whom you attribute your sobriety. Don't you know, my alcoholic friends, that your non-alcoholic brothers and sisters don't even know what sobriety is? They have never lost it. You have. You have. And you attribute your regaining of sobriety to this power greater than yourself, the God of your understanding. Now, if you need somebody to explain to you why you ought to be praying, then nobody on earth can explain it. Nobody. Every human being owes the debt of prayer to God for His goodness to the human being. And if anybody needs an explanation as to why anybody ought to pray, there's nobody can explain it. It's like saying, you know, that you need someone to explain to you why you have to breathe to stay alive. Well, if you don't breathe, you die. Prayer is the food of the soul. It is the oil of the soul. Have you ever noticed yourself becoming despondent? You have all kinds of emotional problems, and you're just hurting. And you feel miserable, and you don't know how to get out of it. I'll lay $1,000 to an empty peanut shell that prayer has probably stopped. You know what's wrong? The soul is not well oiled. Parts are rubbing against parts. What it is, my friends, you're just raw inside. You're starving yourself to death. What do I believe about prayer? Well, there are many kinds. People, you know, in AA meetings, they contrast the prayers. Well, meditation is a whole lot better than the memorized prayers when we were kids. There's no such thing as one kind of prayer being better than another kind of prayer. Prayer is like clothing. We have different kinds for different circumstances. You don't wear a bikini at the North Pole, and you don't wear a parka at the equator. Different prayers fulfill different needs. Meditation fulfills my individual need to fulfill my relationship with God. And memorized prayers usually fill in when I'm incapable of meditation. Do you ever meditate after major surgery? Do you ever pray with a toothache? You don't do it. And how do you pray with other people unless you have a common prayer to recite? What proves this? In many areas, you begin an AA meeting with the private contact with God. Let's all have a moment of silent prayer. And at the end of a meeting, you rise, join hands, and say together,
the Lord's Prayer. It's the old business of, I'm not only an individual, I'm a member of society. I pray one way when I'm by myself, I pray another way when I'm with other people. Hey, besides, you know, all the while you're discussing prayer, ain't nobody praying. And you ever notice, after people become sober, they usually become spiritual experts in about 4 months?
Well, me and God are great buddies, you know. We just talk, him and me.
Well, I mean, that's, I'm not knocking that, for heaven's sake. But I truly believe that very often we kind of half-talk God to death. You ever wonder what a Sunday morning's like up in heaven? And you see the dear Lord looking for a closet screaming, good heavens, here they come again, you know. Sometimes we just verbalize them to death. There are many different kinds of prayer. I will make one statement about prayer. It is not volume that counts. It's like meetings. Consistency counts. It isn't the volume of meetings, it's the regularity or the consistency of them. Same way with prayer. It's not volume, it's consistency. Just pray regularly. Feed yourself regularly. I would suggest a minute a day. 1 minute a day. Is that too much? When you wake up in the morning, can't you offer God this day? He gave it to you. He gave it to you. Can't you wake up and say it's yours? Doesn't take much time, does it? You can make an offering of yourself to God while you're putting your socks on. The effort is almost nil. Costs nothing. It costs nothing to try to repay with an act of gratitude the good God who gave you the very day which you are living. Now, I would suggest that you use, you know, none of us are very good prayers because it's difficult. And usually what we do with difficult things is we quit them. And so I would suggest you get help. Prayer books. That's why they're printed, you know, because they're very valid and they're very, very helpful. And for the alcoholic, I think the best book on earth is a little 24-hour-a-day book because it's geared to your disease. Don't talk about prayer. Pray. Step 12 is AA's crowning glory. Having had a spiritual awakening, as the result of these steps, we now tried to carry the message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs. Well, please notice that 12 comes after the first 11. You know, there are some marvelous things you can learn in AA. Like the first anatomy lesson. If you've never had a course in anatomy, AA teaches you, for example, that when God built the human animal, like other animals, he gave us 2 ears and only 1 mouth. I wonder what he was trying to tell us. Maybe it's to listen twice as much as you talk. And there's another thing that AA teaches. When Bill Wilson wrote these 12 steps, and by the way, he wrote them. I heard somebody ask him if he had help. He said, well, we had about 30 principles that we were living by. Each one was about a paragraph long. But he said, when it came time to write the big book, they asked me to condense them. And he said, I wrote the 12 steps and it took me about a half hour to get them all together. But you know what Bill did after he wrote them? Hold on to your dentures. This is the most profound statement of the day. He numbered them. He put numbers to them. Guess what he was trying to teach us? When all else fails, follow directions. Now, I know that many people have gone on 12-step calls in the middle of their recovery or very early in their recovery, but the ideal says that 12 comes after 11. Having had a spiritual awakening, we then tried to carry it. Now, please, how about this beauty about 12-step work? I've heard people who have gotten well in AA, out of one side of their mouth, they say that alcoholism is a disease. It's a disease of body, mind, emotion, and soul. And out of the other side of their mouths, they'll say, well, I'm not going to help an alcoholic until he admits it and asks for help. I'm saying I'm not going to help him unless and until he makes a rational decision with his irrational mind about his condition. Well, I'll tell you, friends, I have looked at many a copy of AA's big book. I have seen lists of the 12 steps printed in many and many a meeting room around the United States. And never once have I ever seen this. We tried to carry the message to alcoholics who picked up the telephone, called the central office, and asked us to. Don't you know how AA began? Don't you know how AA began? Dr. Bob did not call Bill Wilson. Bill called him. Bill called him. The sober alcoholic looked up the suffering alcoholic. Don't you know what your fifth tradition says? The group has as its one primary purpose, to carry the message to the alcoholic who still suffers. Who still suffers. Now, do you know what's behind AA? Bill Wilson was the man who dreamed the impossible dream and he fought the unbeatable foe. He bore with unbearable sorrow and ran where the brave dared not go. But he knew if he'd only be true to his glorious quest that his heart would lie peaceful and calm when laid to its rest. And the world has been better for this, that one single solitary man, scorned and covered with scars, still strove with his last ounce of courage. He reached the unreachable star. He held within his arms, the arms of his heart, this blinding jewel that men and women had been looking for centuries, sobriety. But he had done it the hard way. He had done it through all the previous 11 steps. But by living these principles, he had become a full human being, free at last. No longer a slave to alcohol, no longer shackled by addiction, a free man made in the image of God. And what he did was act like God. He shared what was his. You know, theologians and philosophers, when asked, why, if God is explanatory of his own happiness, if he can supply his own happiness, why did he create? And nobody knows. God knows, and he won't tell. The only thing the theologians say is this: goodness tends to diffuse itself. In the image of God, Bill Wilson acted like God, and he diffused the goodness that was in his heart, and he shared his sobriety. He shared it, and that's the name of the game. You know what the 12th step is? It is gratitude in action. You don't have to feel grateful. You have to be grateful. Share. I've heard people talk and talk and talk and talk and talk about how grateful they are, and you have a god-awful time getting them to go on a 12-step call. Ladies and gentlemen, let me tell you something. If you are truly grateful, you won't have to tell me. I will see it. I will see it. Because step 12 is nothing more than putting your money where your big fat mouth is. Walk the walk. Walk the walk. Then I'll listen to you talk the talk. Full cycle again. Man is a creature in the image of God made to love God and neighbor. Now listen, please. I wonder if I might not get sober by trying to help another drunk get sober. That's the way Bill started this whole thing, with that question. 40-odd years later, the number of people helped by that principle numbers well over a million. Unbelievable. You know how powerful AA is? The 12 steps of its therapy are so potent and so valid that they are used for other human ailments. NA, Narcotics Anonymous. GA, Gamblers Anonymous. OA, Overeaters Anonymous. EA, Emotions Anonymous. Most emotional behavior is irrational, and these 12 steps help to alleviate some of those conditions. My friends in the AA community, those of you who ought to be in the AA community, and those of you who are not even in it, these 12 steps are the most powerful principles that God has given us to live by. I hope to that same good God that those of you who have found these steps will enjoy the serenity that they will buy you. For if you live them, you cannot help but enjoy a serenity of soul available no other way. They have helped me in my life, and they have given me a bond uniting me to you that no one and nothing else could give. Please know that I pray for you that these steps might mean to you what they have meant to me. I have grown to love them, and I want you to know that you are frequently in my thoughts, often in my prayers, and always in my heart. Thank you for listening to me.